Hi, this is Dr. Carl Goldkamp. If you're interested in learning about the ketogenic diet like I was, to save my own life, then this is probably the podcast for you. 8 years ago, I knew nothing about it. 6 years ago, it saved my life. 3 years ago, I started researching and talking with some of the authorities in the field and attending medical conferences about this to understand why and how keto so dramatically changed my and my wife's Judy's lives. The purpose of this podcast is to share our journey of discoveries with you and understanding how keto is so effective in improving so many different conditions, from obesity, epilepsy, diabetes, infertility, MS, Alzheimer's, heart disease, to name a few. So take a step away from all the hype you've probably heard and roll up your sleeves with me and join me weekly to explore this living miracle that anyone can access. We'll talk science, we'll talk food. We'll explore its history and evolution to today, which is that the sheer wonder of the ketogenic way of eating has changed untold number of lives, unlike anything before it. And in case I forget to mention it, please join our Facebook group, Keto Naturopath. Hi, this is Dr. Goldkamp, and welcome back to another episode of the Keto Naturopath. There's a couple things that have come up this week that I thought would be really interesting to go over. And the first is actually a disappointment that I have. And I've been asked a lot of questions on it, so I figure I probably should mention it on air, as if this is a radio program. And so that is that I will not be doing the interview with Dr. Kilmer McCulley. And it's strange. I learned a lot about prepping for it because I prepped for a lot of my interviews, and everybody who's done an interview with me has done it for free. So there's been no money. This is an unmonetized podcast, in case you didn't notice that. Hope to change that, so at least we can cover the cost of doing the podcast, but neither here nor there. And so in order to honor all the interviewees, I'd go deep into their work so I could ask questions that perhaps weren't asked before and get a little more nuanced and a little more intimate conversation with them about the work that they did. I don't go into their personal lives, of course. So with Dr. McCulley, he sent me his recent 12 papers, which I read, took notes on. He sent me his book online, 300 pages, which I read and took notes on, and scoped out, outlined the interview. It was going to be in December, and then he asked to put it off until January after the holidays because he was working on a paper. Of course, that's fine. And then when we were setting it up for January, he sends me a terse email. He can't do the podcast with me because he's doing a podcast on another platform. I don't really know what that means because I know that's not an answer anybody else that I've interviewed so far would have ever given me. They would have been happy to get the word out on their work and to have a good conversation. So something came up and it's beyond my knowing, but it's very weird in my world to have that sort of last minute pullout. Whether he's being paid and he realized he wasn't getting it paid in mine, I have no idea. But I wanted to announce that because people have asked, hey, when's this podcast going to happen? You got us all interested in homocysteine. Well, guess what? That podcast will happen in a slightly different way. That is, I will outline overall, since now I'm kind of a semi-specialist on that, and actually was since about 20 years ago when I first got into it. And I'll break it down, the good, the bad, and the confusing. But that's not going to be this podcast. All right, so that's off the list. The other thing is I did this week was something caught my attention, and it started with the map of obesity and the rate of obesity changes in the United States primarily. It can go global. And it showed from, and I mentioned this in a few other podcasts about how some states now have a per capita basis of obesity for their entire state about 40%. So that happens to be Mississippi and West Virginia. And there's other states that are not far behind, of course. And you can go into all the factors, and it's interesting that there's a geographic aspect to this. You know, what are the factors in that geography? You can go explore that. But suffice it to say, across the United States, even the healthiest of states, which is Colorado, obesity has become a thing. So when you look at that map, I think most of us have seen, it's a time staggered map from, I believe it's 85 all the way up to 2019, year by year by year, you see the map of the United States. Is it getting basically darker in shades of red? So we've probably all seen that so much, we go, that's amazing, that's amazing, that's amazing. Well, then knowing what I know now about carb and carb addiction and the whole addiction aspect and dopamine and so on, again, another podcast, I go, I wonder if there's a map about addiction. Well, there is a map on addiction, and it's not as perfectly sequenced as the obesity map. It doesn't go on in terms of gradations like that. That's a pretty outstanding map, and there is one you can get from the World Health Organization globally to show what's happening globally. But it's, and I put this together as a, what they call it, an infographic for our Facebook group, and I'm going to put it here for the podcast as well. So the map for addiction is one of 2002 versus 2014. It is an amazing change. So just those two aspects takes your breath away, saying, what the heck has happened? So this is on addiction. And it's measured, actually, to be very specific, it's drug overdose per 100,000 deaths. So it's about people who have died from drug overdose. So can we say it's addiction? Well, it is addiction, but it's one of many addictions out there. It's addiction of drugs, and primarily that would be opiates, and that would be narcotics, all the things that come from the poppy. Morphine, heroin, OxyContin, methadone, etc., all these things. So amazing. So we know, and it's certainly not new information that I'm giving you right now, that there has been an opiate epidemic in the last 2 or 3 years. And the focus of the media is to blame a particular company, and I think that they are culpable, but they are not completely responsible for this epidemic. So in my view, you could use this map to represent all addiction. So what is all addiction? All addiction is alcohol. Certainly it's drugs. Can be sex for some. And the whole mechanism, there certainly is carbs on that. So what is addiction? Addiction. What is addiction? Don't know how the O got there. Addiction is something in which your craving for something takes over your ability to deny it. And it usually has to do with the whole story. Just skimming it right now, is it has to do with these things that you have done, you've eaten or done, increase your dopamine. And eventually, you need to do more of it to have it increase your dopamine to give you that feeling back. But what happens is you keep doing that thing and you actually end up needing more and more and more just to feel normal. To inject a current idea of this, so it could be any of those things. Right? It could be any of those things. So it's a dopamine driver, and it's the path of you need more of it to get that nice high, quote-unquote high. But then you need more of it just to feel normal. So now you're really stuck. So how did that happen? I refer you to the past episodes on addiction. But what I want to say is that there's many substances that represent this thing. And there's a number of great online YouTubes on addiction, so you can learn about this very quickly. We're just going to leave it at dopamine. And where I'm going with this, what is the connection with the obesity map and the addiction map? They have a strong overlap. So the way I see it, and I think the way a lot of other people see it, of this new lens that we've acquired by looking through the lens of low-carb, high-fat, quote-unquote diet, ketogenic diet, is that carbs are an addiction. So now when we look at the addiction map, of just two frames, as a subset of the obesity map, we go, wow, what are the similarities? It confirms the idea that carbs are an addiction, and obesity is merely a side effect of that addiction. In other words, you will grow fat when you eat too many carbs on a consistent basis. So it's no fat shaming or anything else. It's that you're looking at an addict who needs their carbs. In this country, though, there isn't the education to get around that concept to people who need it. So you then get often a demographic correlation with those that are have the cheapest aspect of food. And so now we know we can get calorie-rich and nutrient-poor food, hence carbs, whether they're cereals and so on and so forth, that so they are the door is open for them. It's like getting free alcohol to an alcoholic. Well, they're obviously going to go so far that it's probably going to kill them. You know, it totally relies on that kind of alcoholic and that particular context that I just described, all on self-discipline. We know that self-discipline is a part of it, but it's not the bigger story. It's not the truthful story. Addiction has a lot to do with a mental predisposition. Neurotransmitter predisposition. And how do we get this back in balance? It's pretty tricky, very tricky, but it can be done. So it can be done. Yes, self-discipline is part of it. Cognitive therapy, being aware of your choices, is part of it. Group support is part of it. Cultural inclusion is part of it. Social isolation is a driver of it, among other things. So these are things that we can look at. So now we go, oh my gosh, this is a huge correlation between those two. And then I got to thinking, actually, let me stay on the obesity part. You know, when we think about how did obesity get started in these maps, you know, back in the good old days, when I was still alive, still alive now, back, I was still alive back then too, but in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, there really wasn't much in the way of obesity in terms of these particular graphs. And so you have to say, well, what happened? You know, how did this suddenly, somebody drop a bomb, and are we getting sort of like Lyme disease in reverse, but it's about obesity in the sense that it just sprang up out of nowhere? Sort of yes, and sort of no. And so now we come back to, well, really, it's about carbs. And if you just heard my statement, it's about carbs, and carbs are addicted, and they are the driver of addiction and obesity, you'd say, that's not enough for me to believe you. I totally buy it. So let me give you a little more, is that what happened is companies came in, the food manufacturing companies came in, and they used to be the tobacco companies, bought the food manufacturing companies. They learned how to make cigarettes addictive until they got caught. And then they moved over and they bought food manufacturing companies, and they learned how to make those addictive. So it's not just all those cereals. Walk down the cereal aisle. What's the difference between the cereal aisle nowadays and the candy aisle and the cookie aisle? They're all identical. The same crap and all that food. And it's not just, even if you believed in you need your carbs, so wait a minute, it's whole grains. First of all, that's off my list now anyway, but that's certainly what I taught for about 16 years or so. None of those are whole grains. So what it is some sort of ultra, ultra, ultra refined carbohydrate stripped of everything and then added, so they came from a plant, so we can call that plant-based diet for you guys that need to think that way. And then they added these additives, preservatives, natural flavors, quote unquote. And we know that's not a natural item. And we won't even go into the pesticides that were on those plants to start with. But that's what you're getting in your foods. Let's go back to tobacco. What was tobacco? It's a plant. And you can bet it had plenty of pesticides on it. And so they dried it out, you know, the big tobacco farms throughout the South. And let me tell you about tobacco. Did you know that there's 4 states that basically made about 100% of all the tobacco in the United States and pretty much the world? And so those 4 states have 2 senators per state, so there's 8 senators. Where am I going? Is that these senators voted as a block. So anytime there was new legislation in the Senate that needed passing, for whatever reason, unrelated to tobacco, they came to the block. And in order to get them to sign off this block of 4 states, they were told, we'll vote for your thing, your bill, and it'll help you get it passed if you agree to never vote against any tobacco legislation. So that's how it got to go from the 50s to the 90s, early 2000s, for the tobacco companies finally to realize they've been lying this whole time. Okay, that's interesting to know. So there's a lot of politics behind this, a lot of money behind this. This isn't innocent. And so after that aspect, the tobacco companies knew how to add in a lot of things to their tobacco. They added in additives, they added in flavors, natural flavors, and of course they had the pesticides and so on. So that's what they were smoking. It wasn't simply tobacco ground up and rolled up in a cigarette. You know, for those people who roll their own, they had a far safer cigarette. So they hyper-concentrated the nicotine. That's the driving addictive substance, and they added in other substances. So in their engineered product, they knew how to support the dopamine pathway, really kick it into gear, pop that sucker up. At the same time of, this is deep neurotransmitter, to shut off the connection with your, what you call prefrontal lobes, which is your thinking and your reflective, your meditative part. You're, you know, thinking about, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. So you're all about going to do this. It's like the training of a greyhound to race a track, just all or nothing, all or nothing. There's no second thoughts. Everything's about life or death. So then they move that over to the foods. So now you have three aisles that represent the same kind of foods, a lot of sugar, a lot of carbs, a lot of additives, a lot of all the other crap. That happened. That happened in the mid-80s. In the late 70s, what happened, 1977, was the dietary guidelines. First dietary guidelines ever in the United States was created and said we needed to eat a high-carb diet, low-fat diet. And we know that was based on Ansel Keys and all that fake information. So we're redoing that. So why do I say this? Why do all these maps spring out of the late 70s and early 80s and shazam, as if the world just changed, as if a cloud just blew over the United States and inseminated everybody with a new way of eating? So that's what happened. Isn't that amazing? So that's just grown more and more and more. And so there's so much money being made of this processed food by encouraging addiction to this processed foods. You know, the advertisements all around it, the cartoons to drive the kids to get these particular products, et cetera, et cetera. But don't be fooled. You know, there is no such thing as an essential carbohydrate. If you never had another carbohydrate orally, that is, call it exogenous, in your life, you would do just fine. And it took me a long time to get over that part. You know, why aren't we doing whole grains? Why aren't we doing, you know, what about all those, you know, leafy green vegetables? Those are fine. If you want to eat those are fine. Stay away from the starches and so on and so forth. I've taken the step of gradually moving away from all of that, primarily out of convenience, and I feel fine. And I wondered, why do I feel fine? Aren't I supposed to have fallen apart by now? And the whole fiber issue and all these other issues, those are all good issues and they need to be looked at. And they have been looked at in a way, and I think they're artificial issues. I think that once we, this construction, this artificial construct of we needed high carbs is now being broken up. You know, the idea, why is it you need fiber? By the way, you do get fiber in meat and fish and everything else. You don't get as much as with veggies. But the whole idea, well, fiber does this. I believed all that, you know. Fiber creates short-chain fatty acids and so on and so forth. Well, guess what? When you eat meats and fat, you create ketones. BHB, beta-hydroxybutyrate, is the same ketone that would have been created from those short-chain fatty acids. In fact, BHB is a short-chain fatty acid. It's a high antioxidant fatty acid. It actually lowers your oxidation, so therefore drops the amount of oxidants that you're producing. So that's amazing. So you go, well, that kind of argument fell apart. Well, it's for colon health, the fiber. Well, you know, think it through. And let me say, I got into this because of colon health, and I'm hale and hearty, quite examined a number of times. So, and I'm not the only one on this story. So I think a lot of that, those constructs were there for an ulterior reason. So there's that. So now let's introduce another map. Where do you think that other map's going to be? What do you think that other map's, well, it's on the podcast so you can see it. It's Alzheimer's. Because I started thinking, you know, what other maps, you know, over, you know, look at the same sort of topic. And so another one is Alzheimer's. Where the heck did that come from? Yes, I know it was diagnosed. I mean, the term was in the 1800s came up, what was Alzheimer's, named after the doctor who coined it and discovered the syndrome. But the amounts, the incidence in the population was not very high at all. It springs out of the late 70s and early 80s and just goes on like the steamroller. And it's between diabetes, which is really not a cofactor, it's a comorbidity with obesity for the most part. Yes, you can be obese and not be diabetic. I understand that. But I'm saying the rates are pretty much in lockstep. If you look at obesity, if you look at diabetes, they're pretty much lockstep. Now you put in another graph line, which is Alzheimer's, which is the majority of all dementias, about 60 plus percent of all dementias, and there's various different kinds of dementia. We're talking about cognitive impairment, and we've talked a number about this on various past podcasts. So, and you know, I refer you back to not only my coverage on this topic, but especially the three-part interview with Dr. Kunane and look into his work, and the links are there as well. So now you have three maps and you realize, oh my gosh, these three factors are happening at the same time. You have addiction, map is increasing, it's getting worse. You have the obesity, and the maps look very similar. It's not just rates of change, it's the geography. You think with all this moving around of people, the geography wouldn't be that specific, but I guess there's enough people that stay in the same place to make it relevant. Now you look at obesity, and the obesity map really looks like a cross between the diabetes map and a strong orientation to the opiate maps, the death by opiates. And that's interesting. You say, why is that? Well, I would say that that speaks a lot to the medicalization of our population. One of the things that I go over in our that course, our men's weight loss course, and it'll be a woman's weight loss course soon enough, is that the average person in their mid-50s is on 5 medications. And what do you think happens with those 5 medications? Do you think those 5 medications made you healthier? And I understand on a per-incident basis, you get into some trauma and you need to take some meds as pain relievers and so on and so forth, or whatever else it is, but not forever. It's very hard to justify a forever medication. In fact, there are no forever or any long-term studies beyond a few years on any medication. And there are no studies on people on 2 or more medications. So the idea that you have now this the average population in the United States in their mid-50s on 5 medications, that's never been studied. And the contraindications that are there. But the larger point is, I believe, for me, it drives, it creates, it inspires, however you want to look at it, drug-induced nutrient deficiencies. So when you now have a nutrient deficiency, you think about, well, wait a minute, isn't that all the really poor areas of the world, like the various villages in Africa, sorry for the stereotype Africa, or the poor areas in India or wherever you think, or Haiti, or even parts of Indonesia and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Isn't that where malnourishment is? In part, it might be. That's what we tend to think of malnourished. No, we're at a new generation, multi-generation. It didn't start this generation, a couple generations ago, of drug-induced nutrient deficiencies. So the average person on 5 medications, how many nutrient deficiencies do you think they've accumulated? Now let's put a factor of time in with that. So it's 5 medications that induce 5, well, it's going to be more. Often they're multi-nutrient deficiencies created by one medication. So now you have those deficiencies times 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40. Where do you think that goes? So we've induced nutrient deficiencies, measurable nutrient deficiencies. And there's easy ways to measure this. Blood tests, obviously. And so we have a whole new aging population that is malnourished. That's the word you should use. It's malnourished times all these periods of times. What do you think that happens there? Do you think maybe some of their faculties might decline prematurely, earlier than they should? Yeah, duh. So that's the issue here, is that now you put this map together and what you have is a country that's becoming gradually more addicted to very poor quality foods that then need medications to address these things that then drive a deeper nutrient deficiency that then cause, well, premature death, et cetera, but we're looking at cognitive impairment, MCI, mild cognitive impairment, dementia, and of that subset, Alzheimer's. I think that's amazing. It is so crystal clear at this point. These are the things that the last 30 years anyways, the Alzheimer's or the diabetes map really springs out of the mid-80s. That's 15, that's 20, that's 35 years. So in the last 35 years, this has blossomed in front of us? That's amazing. So what's going to happen when the states get to be 60% obese? Can you imagine a state that's 70% obese? What's that swimming pool or tennis court or track going to look like? I don't know. I really don't know. And I feel badly because those who are becoming obese, it's not their fault. It really is not their fault. So this information needs to get out, and I think people can take it into their own hands. But I think the hardest thing people are going to come to is that addictive. It takes greater insight to look at addiction than it does simply to label the kind of foods and to look at your macros. I'll drop back on my, you know, you're not a robot. And if you truly are addicted to carbohydrates, so mostly you are, most of me is, is that it takes some insight and pulling back. And that takes some discipline. It takes some understanding / cognitive behavior therapy / group support. You know, you need to have people in your tribe that look like you, that are thinking of like you, so you don't feel isolated or isolated in your community. We are isolated. In one way, I'm isolated in my community. None of my neighbors would have any idea what I'm talking about. They think it's crazy talk. So that is something that is necessary. So you go to conferences to be part of that tribe. I don't mean to be a follower. I really dislike followers. I mean to go to learn more and to ask intelligent questions in order to break into your new life, in order to go back to the way you've been, peel back these layers here that I've just described, is to learn things and to ask questions. Don't take somebody at 100% truthfulness. I've listened to a number of presentations and I go, oh, a few good points and a few bad points, a few good points and a few bad points. So you try to collect the good points and you ask about why they say those other points, and if they can't defend them, or you suspect that there's a high prejudice or something else that they couldn't offer the candor of why they disagree with you on a certain points, let it go. But there's plenty to learn, build on what you know, feel confident about what you know, and implement it. I mean, this is about doing it. It's about engagement. So I put that at your doorstep. That's in essence of what we do, by the way. And this isn't an ad for that, but you have to say that. Education is the number one drug that we need to have injected into our brain to reverse all this. And some of it is reversible. Let's not kid ourselves. When we've seen the pictures of Alzheimer's and or dementia for that matter, we see that the brain has actually changed. That's not going to go presto changeo back to a whole brand new brain. Let's give that one up. But we can reverse a lot of the aspects of Alzheimer's. And that's dramatic. It's a big dramatic improvement. We obviously can reduce, let's say, Verta Health. They're up to not even 50% of their conversion. That's a big deal. My whole avenue of explorations, the questions that I have learned to ask of other people is, what happened to the 50% that are not getting benefits? Few people want to talk about that. You know, you kind of separate yourself from the tribe when you ask questions like that, but it makes those tight core members that are more truthful and honest and know what's going on appreciate those kind of things and answer that kind of question. And I think that's what needs to be answered. Why isn't this working for everybody? And it's not like we all have different DNA. That's too much of a very bland, nebulous answer that has no specificity. So I am going to wrap that up, and I hope that you got fascinated with understanding the correlation of these three different categories of maps and realizing that there's a kind of uniformity. It'd be a great research project for somebody, but somebody needs to be paid some money, and where does that come from? There's less and less research about diet nowadays, and that's really hard. So it's really hard to argue any particular aspect of nutrition based on studies, because all studies on nutrition come down to a thing called epidemiology. And nutritional epidemiology is just based on retrospective observation, you know, people filling out what they think they've eaten. And that's a very poor kind of study. So basically, there's nothing there. That's not to say that this is all for naught. This is to say we're in a new era of this, and things are now being looked at and organized, and some things are being done. But you need a government to sponsor it. And you need more philanthropists and so on. So this is shaking a lot of boats. This is threatening a lot of financial interests to go down this line. However, when you have things like obesity, diabetes, and Alzheimer's, and addiction, taking a huge toll on our economy. So I've been told, and I do believe, that that could be the motivation to get larger funding sources involved. Certainly, I would appreciate regulations on pesticides, herbicides, food quality, labeling, very pro-labeling. It's funny how that, how is labeling not a common sense thing that this government should have, but it's been voted down how many times? The only state that actually had it passed was Vermont, and then the companies came in and they overrode that, you know, they undid that by funding the appropriate lobbyists, et cetera, et cetera. So here you go. I hope that was insightful. I hope you appreciated it, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Dr. Goldkamp. I just wanted to encourage you to send in your questions to drgoldkamp@ketonaturopath.com. Many of you have, and so what I've done with these questions that gotten back to most of the people I email, but some of the questions that were so good, and if they were overlapping to other questions, I would combine them and try to put that into the topic of a podcast, either via one of the micro topics that are covered in an interview. As you know, we cover a lot of topics in any given interview, or some of my own sort of reporting, if you will, on some of these issues. So please keep the questions coming. Feel free to send in an email, and I will get back to you. One thing I want to say, a number of questions have come in which I've given this answer and the email didn't work. So just make sure that you're receiving at the same email that you sent it in. And I think that might have been the difficulty. So I look forward to your questions. I just wanted to make sure that you knew that I'm open to answer your questions. And I think this world of keto is not just black and white. You know, it's nice that it's simple, but it's not simple for some. I'm really trying to, you know, go down, as anybody, any of you who have listened to all my podcasts, we started way back when, history of evolution and epilepsy and so on and so forth. You know, now we're seeing some tremendous overlap in various mental disorders, such as schizophrenia or neurological disorders that are not just epilepsy. And also, just for people in losing weight, it's sometimes pretty complicated for them to engage in keto, and so they need some help. And so that's the whole point of, at least that's what I think I'm doing, is exploring the world of why are there other factors. So in exploring some of those other factors, we've covered addiction, we've covered hormones, we've covered nutritional deficiencies, we've covered certain metabolic lab results, and we'll go further. We'll even get to more on genome and aspects. So these are all just contributions that make for an obstacle for some people to engage easily in the ketogenic diet. This is my belief, and these are the things that I've discovered. And I think other people have discovered some of these things, but not ever put them together. So stay listening, send in your questions, and I will definitely get back to you. Thank you.